Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we are so happy that Mom's back with us today. Hi, Caroline, also known as Mom.
Yeah, well, I'm happy. The sun's trying to shine again. No snow, no ice. I'm just very happy.
Well, she's in Iowa, so that's important there. I'm in Texas. We don't see snow and ice too much down here in Austin. And we'll find out in a moment where our guest is today. Do you want to introduce her?
Yes, I would like to. Our book today is Under a Gilded Moon, and it's an interesting book. It really is. And the author is Joy Jordan Lake, and she's the author of 8 books, including A Tangled Mercy, a number one Amazon bestseller, and also an Editor's Choice recipient from the Historical Novel Society. Blue Hole Back Home, which won the Christie Award for First Novel, and a children's book, Crazy Much Law. She was raised in the foothills of the Appalachians, and this book is set in the Appalachians and in North Carolina. And it's a very interesting book, and I know that you're going to enjoy talking to her and listening to what she has to say about this, and you would enjoy reading it. So welcome to the program, Joy.
Oh, thank you so much, Monica and Caroline both. What a lovely.
So where are you calling us from today?
I live just south of Nashville now, but I have, in my past, I've lived in Texas as well as New England and a bunch of other places.
And, of course, the Appalachians. Now, this book is set in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. How far do the Appalachian Mountains, you know, where all do they stretch?
Well, the Appalachian Trail goes from, I believe, North Georgia up to Maine. So you can really, you know, big mountains.
Oh, my God.
You're in, you call them the Smokies or Great Smoky Mountains. And when you're in Western North Carolina, you know, it's the Blue Ridge. And I guess, yeah, don't they call them the Blue Ridge as well? But, or the Shenandoah. Anyway. You know, it's this lovely, they're ancient mountains, which is why they're not as tall as the Rockies, but they're certainly, I would argue, just as beautiful. But yeah, the trail, I've had a number of friends who would take a semester off from college and go hike the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine or Maine to Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of that.
But when we think about Appalachia, we do think about the South more than up into New England, don't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And of course, in the era of this novel, it's the 1890s. And there was just tremendous poverty in Western North Carolina on these farms. And if you've ever tried to plant a tree or dig a hole, anyone from this area, you know, it's very rocky soil, very rich in some areas, but tough farming. And so it was really mostly just subsistence. So they were, you know, they were barely getting by, most of these farmers in this area.
And do they still farm there today, or is it all coal mines now?
Well, the, you know, coal mining's probably, to be fair, more West Virginia these days. Western North Carolina is stunningly beautiful now. During this period, the land had really been out of desperation. The farmers, it was very much deforested. The land that George Vanderbilt bought for the, like, 125,000 acres, if you can believe it, for the Biltmore Estate, most deforested, very much over-farmed, lots of erosion, and it was badly damaged land. These days, Western North Carolina is, you know, is a hiker's paradise, and, you know, it's just fabulously gorgeous. And it's been reforested and all that. But, you know, that's part of the tension of this novel, is these folks just trying to survive in the Appalachians, and these very wealthy people coming down from the north. And, you know, none of us take well to newcomers coming in and telling us that we've done things wrong, or you know, buying our land if we're not in the mood to sell, or, you know, so that's part of the tensions that in the background of the novel.
What drew you to this time period to write about?
I think, you know, partly we're all, I loved the Downton Abbey series on PBS. And, you know, there's something fascinating about the Gilded Age in this era, and also, you know, both very charming, but also very worrisome, the immense wealth that could be used for beautiful ways. George Vanderbilt collected art and books and fine horses and built this gorgeous estate. Some of his brothers and sisters used their money in ways that some of us would be kind of horrified by. You know, they'd have parties where they would roll up $100 bills for people to smoke. You know, they would smoke the paper.
Oh my gosh.
Right? I mean, even today, that's quite a party favor, right? But especially in the Gilded Age, this was just so extravagant. Or they'd have parties, for those who've been to Newport, Rhode Island, the so-called cottages up there, a couple were owned by George's siblings, older brothers and sisters-in-law, and they, one of the parties there, they put sand all over the lawn, and guests came out and sifted through the sand for diamonds and rubies and emeralds. That was one of the party games. You know, so there was that kind of thing going on in the Gilded Age. And then, you know, and then, of course, you have the industrialization and people trying to adjust to change. And the many of these folks in the Appalachians had been quite isolated until the trains had only recently come in by the time he built his house in 1895. And, you know, so they were still adjusting to these people coming in from other parts of the country who used things like cash. You know, this was very much a barter economy where you took your apples or your chestnuts or your chickens, whatever you had to sell, and traded for whatever you needed, where you just didn't even deal with money. And then you have somebody like George Vanderbilt coming in with millions. And, you know, just the clash of cultures was, as you can imagine, for people who've been isolated for generations, it sets up quite a conflict. So I think that's partly in real life, I hate conflict. But, you know, as a writer, you've got to run toward the conflict because that's where the stories get interesting. So I think that's partly what drew me to the time period.
Well, I was interested to note that Mr. Vanderbilt himself was quite a kind man. And it was some of the other people associated with him that caused the problems.
You're very right, Caroline. I was interested, too. I really tried to keep an open mind going into the research because I knew, you know, as we all do, a little bit about the robber barons and the sort of pretty brutal business techniques that George's father and grandfather had used to build this empire, mm-hmm. you know, railroads and that sort of thing. But George himself and all my research, he really began to feel like a good friend, you know, somebody I'd do coffee with regularly. He just, mm-hmm. he loved books and horses and dogs. He loved the North Carolina mountains. He could have built anywhere in the world, literally. And he chose the same spot that I was in love with, the Western North Carolina mountains. And if you've ever been to the Biltmore, have either of you ever been to the Biltmore Estate?
I have not, but now I want to go.
Oh, good. As soon as the pandemic's over. It's this setting that you look out on and just cannot believe. It's just so gorgeous. And, you know, so I think that really drew me to him even years before I started this novel, just that kind of sense of how interesting that this man who could have built anywhere in the world, he traveled all over, and he chose essentially the same spot I would have, me and my 79 Mercury Zephyr. We have the same taste, it turns out. So,
now, in this time period, he was not married. Did he ever marry?
He did eventually. You're right. He was not married in this time period, and he was one of the premier bachelors, you know, with all
I'll
his this single guy. He was much more interested, everybody said, in playing chess with just one friend or reading a book by himself by the fire with his dog, Cedric, his big St. Bernard, or just walking through the woods with a couple of friends. He was very close to a couple of his nieces. But he, you know, he just was content traveling the world, collecting art, reading books. He kept a careful log of all the books he'd read, and he was a voracious reader. He finally married when he was 33. And they just had one child, and she was a fascinating person. I hated not to get to write about her, but she comes a good bit later, a few years later.
Well, that's another book, right?
That's right. Another book. I like the way you think.
I just Googled him, George Vanderbilt. He's actually a pretty handsome guy, too.
Yeah, he really is. He had that sort of the mandatory, you know, thin mustache of the era. And yeah, very, very handsome. And as you say, very kind. He one story that comes up about him in some of the old records is he one night at a big dinner, the banquet hall at Biltmore seats like 40 people, you know, very grand in this massive vaulted ceiling. It's just gorgeous. And three enormous fireplaces, which were my favorite part. But one of the new kitchen maids, essentially, who was waiting on the table, dropped a platter and just, you know, it made this big mess. And he just quietly said, come see me in my office later. And she assumed, of course, that she was about to be sacked. And she came in and he just very, you know, I think he assigned her to another task or just reassured her that everything was fine. And he just wanted to take that opportunity to tell her it was okay, not give her, you know, give her the boot. So there are a good many stories in the letters and archives about him like that, that just make you think, oh, you know, be my friend.
Uh-huh. And yeah. It's interesting. You wonder what was the influence that made him like that when obviously some of his siblings were not, and his father and, you know, the reputation that they had for being so hard-nosed. I wonder where he got this from.
You know, and that's such a great question. He was the youngest of eight children and was kind of sickly as a kid, as I recall, and just was essentially left to read and be highly educated and travel the world, mostly with his mother, because he was so much younger than the older brothers who were kind of pressed into servitude in the family business. And they worked long, long hours. I believe one of them became an alcoholic. Just, you know, as much as you don't want to feel sorry for someone, you know, with that many millions, you kind of feel sorry for them. They worked these terrible hours. And really were under tremendous pressure from their father, from George's father. But George, the youngest, just really, you know, was kind of left to his own education and just had, his father and mother both, you know, really loved him. And but I get the feeling that a lot of his influence, as you say, came from maybe his mother, with whom he was very close, and the books he was reading. He thought for a while about becoming an Episcopal priest. He was very interested in serving other people. He was very interested in philanthropy. So he was having a lot of the conversations with, he had a close friend who was an Episcopal priest, whom he later brought down to be the rector of a church, an Episcopal church that still stands today. That's gorgeous. They're right near the Biltmore. But the conversations he was having with clergy and other people was, how do you help people without hurting their culture, which of course is the same conversation we're having these days of how do you help without hurting? And it's fascinating. So they were trying to be very careful. He very much wanted to help the Appalachian folks who were living in poverty. But he was also very aware you can't just go in and hand out money, you know, that takes away people's dignity. So he later came up with Biltmore Industries and these just fascinating ideas for helping the mountain people sell their own crafts. So there's another whole story there.
There you go. You've got some more books coming. Okay.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Joy Jordan Lake, author of Under a Gilded Moon, which is a historical novel set in the 1890s at the Biltmore Estate. How many of the characters in this book are drawn from history other than George Vanderbilt himself?
Oh, I love that question because that's always one of my first questions when I read it. The first one that pops into my head is, I'll start further back than that. I started by looking who really would have been there at the actual Biltmore in 1895. And records say that the head of the stables was an Italian guy. So there's an Italian in this novel who is head of the stables. And I also discovered there was this terrible lynching in the early 1890s. And I'd never heard of this. And all the history classes I'd taken never heard of this. And my husband's Italian. So that was very intriguing to me that there was so much prejudice against the, especially Southern Italians, not so much Northern Italians, but my husband's from, their family's from Sicily and Calabria, lots of prejudice toward Sicilians. And so, there's a Sicilian in the novel who's one of the main characters. And he himself is not actually historical, but based on these people who escaped from the lynching that being blamed for the murder of the police chief in New Orleans. And so several Italians were lynched and several of them escaped. And then there's a French chef who's based on the historical French chef there at the Biltmore. And the housekeeper was British. So there's a British housekeeper. One of the main characters is named Lily Bertellamy, and she is based loosely on the Lily Bart in Edith Wharton's novel House of Mirth, if anyone has read that. I love that novel. And so this Lily in my novel is supposed to be the niece of Edith Wharton, as if Edith Wharton later then bases her novel on her niece.
That's a little inside right. Connection, right?
Little English nerd right there. But the most chilling one to me, who's the historical character, and then there's several, lots of people around the edges. Two more people I should name. One is Robert Bratchett. He's sort of a secondary character, but I really wanted to put him in as a sort of a memorial to the real Robert Bratchett, African-American man in that area. And it wasn't until 1897 that he died in a very tragic way. I just wanted him. And so he's memorialized actually at the Center for the Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. Just this tragic story. So anyway, I wanted to put him in the novel because he lived in this area and met a tragic end. And so he is this very positive character in the novel. And then one of the villains is a man named Madison Grant. And I'd never heard of him before, but he is historical and he ran in the same social circles as the Vanderbilts up in New York. He came from old money and on the good side, he did a number of things that we still appreciate today. He is partly responsible for our having Glacier National Park. He saved the American buffalo, essentially, organized that effort. He founded the Bronx Zoo, helped raise the money from that, collected money from the Vanderbilts and other families. So he did some fascinating things, but he also became increasingly obsessed with eugenics.
That's what interested me. And then the Third Reich.
Yes.
I thought, oh my gosh, you know, they got some ideas from him, I guess.
They absolutely did, Caroline, you're right. That's where it was so chilling to me was he was part of this sizable group of American intellectuals from a lot of our Ivy League schools. He went to Yale and he was an attorney. I don't think he ever practiced law, but he had a law degree. And as Caroline says, he ended up writing a book. He was becoming, at this stage, when my book is written, interested in eugenics and involved in that movement. He became increasingly obsessed with it. And so by the 1920s, he writes this book called Passing of the Great Race. And he's referring to the white race. And he's just obsessed with the idea that white people are going to disappear. He writes this book and it sold well. And one of the people who read it was Adolf Hitler. And Hitler wrote him a fan letter, if that's not true. So you're absolutely right. There's...
Oh, that is just, that's unbelievable. It really is. Well, you have to wonder where Hitler got all his ideas, and now we know where he got some of them, I guess.
Right. And it's a good reminder to those of us who are Americans, if ever Hollywood lets us think that, oh, those awful Germans, isn't it a shame that Germany produced Hitler and we had our hands completely clean? You know, people like Madison Grant are a good reminder that, you know, there are a lot of Americans and British folks and French folks and, you know, a lot of folks writing and thinking in ways that led to, you know, the Third Reich. So,
and Madison Grant got some of his ideas from France.
Yes. Yes, he did, from France and from England. There was a prominent intellectual there too, who was writing and researching. I put researching in quotes and air quotes. But yeah, that, you know, I think a lot of us probably study the eugenics movement in what, middle school maybe, or high school, or, but you know, you pass over it fairly quickly. So it was interesting to me to go back and really read some of this stuff. That's just really chilling. You know, and you realize where this leads, you know, leads straight to the Holocaust. Once you start talking about, you know, people like Madison Grant started talking about, you know, how do you keep the race pure? And he takes that idea and becomes increasingly dangerous over the years as his ideas get more and more frightening.
Now, in your book, Under the Gilded Moon, you have him having influence, or Under a Gilded Moon, sorry. He's influencing some of the local citizens with these ideas because they're ripe for it, because they are seeing foreigners coming in and taking some of their jobs. Well, not really. They didn't have the jobs in the first place, and maybe didn't have the skill for the jobs, and maybe didn't even want those particular jobs, but they still felt like they were being displaced by foreigners. And was that something that was happening there at the time too?
You know, partly yes. And then partly, you know, just the history of what it is to be human. You know, anytime any of us, you know, are fearful about change, it's easy to look around and want to blame someone else. And change is hard. You know, human beings kind of tend to resist, I think by nature, most of us resist change. It's scary. And, you know, I had in my mind, my husband loves the song, the title slipping my mind, but the chorus being, you know, only a pawn in the game. And I kept thinking about that line, only a pawn in the game, that, you know, through history, when people like Madison Grant have used, even though he himself came from education and money, but he used people with very little money and very little education as pawns in his game to try to breed resentment, you know, against the foreigners coming in, or against.
And certainly we don't see that happening today, do we?
Good thing we don't.
Oh, wow. As I was reading this book, I kept thinking, wow, the more things change, the more they stay the same. There were so many parallels with what's going on today. The resentment against immigrants and against anyone with a browner skin.
I was struck with the same thing, Monica. It really was. At times I would stop and think, oh my heavens, am I rereading today's news story, or am I researching for this novel? It was really striking. And it's, you know, I think the one encouraging thing is, even though it's discouraging that we have to keep having the conversations, encouraging that, you know, there can be times when our conversations become very divided and very violent even. And, you know, we seem to usually figure out ways to move forward. And, but you know, it's a good cautionary tale to look back and realize, wow, let's not repeat all the mistakes of the past. Let's try to learn something here about, right, not blaming. And it, you know, it's striking too, when you read the exact same rhetoric, for example, towards Southern Italians, some of the lines you could pluck out, and they would sound like they were being applied to a different ethnic group today.
Exactly.
That nobody thinks now. You know, nobody tries to argue that, oh, those Sicilians, man, they're taking over Hollywood.
Or the Irish got it too. Apparently that wasn't so much an issue here in Appalachia, but in other parts of the country, the Irish were treated that way as well.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, they're in Appalachia. You have quite a few people from Scotch Irish descent. My dad's family comes from that, so that we were. There's a butler named Moncrief in the book, just a very secondary character. But my father's name was Moncrief, and so the butler's a little. That's a fun ethnic heritage too, the Scottish people. But there's a strong sense of pride among some, at least where I grew up in East Tennessee, a sense of connection with the Scotch-Irish. But you're right. Depending on the part of the country, other parts of the country, the Irish were, big signs in the window, right?
Yes. No Irish need apply.
Right.
Yeah.
Joy, are all the books that you've written historical novels?
No, these past two decidedly are historical, and the one before that, depending on where you count historical starting, is set in the late 1970s. so when I mentioned that I'm working on the next one being a historical novel set in coastal Maine in the 1950s, my mother was horrified that I would call that historical. I am not historical. I was married in the 50s, so she was horrified. But I have written been some nonfiction books and an academic book and one children's picture book with another one coming out. So, but I do love writing historical novels. It's a lot of fun. You get to travel to another place as well as another time.
Definitely. Do you find those that you do a lot of research for them, and do you do the writing and the research at the same time, or do you do a lot of research and then sit down to write?
I'm learning over time. My first one, A Tangled Mercy, was the first book I ever, or the first definite one you would call historical. It was the first book I ever began. And I was supposed to be working on my doctoral dissertation. I was living up in New England. And I just became fascinated with Charleston, South Carolina, and these people, historical folks and events that were related to what I was supposed to be working on. What I really wanted to do was work on this novel in my head. And so I took a week with my then baby girl and my husband, and we drove down to Charleston, did some research, and I thought, so naively, I thought, this is great. I'll just quietly take 4 months off from my dissertation writing. I'll pound out this novel. My husband has a roommate from his old Harvard days who has a friend he met at a cocktail party in New York who's a big dog literary agent. So I'll land that agent because I'm just sure he'll want, this no-name writer.
Of course.
I just had it all planned out. And I would research and write this novel in 4 months. And I had how many pages I was going to write a day. And then I would go back to the dissertation before they noticed I was, had gone AWOL. Of course, it didn't work out at all that way.
Okay, but, did any of that happen?
The only part that happened was my baby girl and my husband did travel down with me for a week.
Okay, understood.
That is it.
But I'm really curious, what is it that you were writing your dissertation on, and what was it that you found in that sparked the novel?
I love your questions. So I was writing on this really obscure topic that I found fascinating, which is the only reason anyone ever gets a PhD, only because they become interested in this obscure topic that nobody else in their right mind would ever spend any time on. But I ran across this footnote that there were these novels written in response to Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. And they were written by women who were pro-slavery. But they were written in response, as a defense, trying to defend slavery by also writing a novel and also using mother-child imagery like Harriet Beecher Stowe does, but for the opposite side, instead of to release the slaves to make sure everybody stays in bondage. And they are horrifying. I'm not a big horror movie person at all, but I guess this was my version of why people are fascinated. And they're just amazingly bad. And But I was just so interested how they use the same things that tug at your heartstrings. If you've ever read Uncle Tom's Cabin, even though it's very sentimental to our, you know, 2020 taste, and there, you know, there are all kinds of problems with it for a 2020, you know, perspective. But it, I mean, you know, it tears your heart out that babies are being ripped from mother's arms. It's, you know, it would definitely get you off the fence if you were trying to decide if you were an abolitionist or not. Anyway, so that was my topic. I began looking at these novels and ran across some events in Charleston, South Carolina that I was fascinated by. And in the course of it was 20 years writing that novel. I ended up having more babies. I wrote other books that got published. I finished, you know, academic degrees and stuff, and 20 years went by with this stupid book that would not get published. It kept coming so close, and somebody would be all excited about it, and it would fall through. And so it was 20 years later. And as I said, I had published a bunch of other books by that time when this thing finally got finished. But, and I'll try to tell this really briefly, but literally the week that my agent had, not the agent from the cocktail party in New York, I might add, this is years later, my fabulous agent, Elizabeth Weed, had sent me some notes on, okay, looks great. I think, you know, you've revised this beautifully. Now, just a couple of notes here of things you might want to look at. Get these changes back to me this week, and I'll send it out on submission to see which publishing houses might want to acquire it. And very exciting. This was June 2015. And I was up in my attic office making the final changes, and my daughter, the one who was the baby girl in the original research, at that point, I believe, was a college student just home for the summer, and came running from her bedroom saying, Mom, turn on the radio. Something horrible has happened in Charleston. And over the intervening years, I had taken my family back to Charleston many times, allegedly to do research for this book that would not get published. You know? But we would go to the beach and we'd eat great food. And we, you know, so they began to be really into, let's go do research, Mom. We don't care if this novel is ever published. You know, we'll go ride the waves. And so they knew Charleston well, and they had even been to a place called Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, because I did some research there and set part of the novel there. And of course, there was this horrible massacre, the shooting of 9 parishioners during a Bible study. And it was literally, one of the main characters was named Pinckney, and that was the first person shot, the pastor of the church. And many of the chapters in this novel were set at that church because it's so historically significant. I mean, it was just horrible. It was just horrible because it was just this heartbreaking thing that all of us, you know, literally around the world were watching the news for and just brokenhearted. And my agent called me or we were texting back and forth, emailing and saying, you know, well, I guess this novel's got to be put away forever, because it looked like I had written the novel knowing that the shooting was going to happen and then just, oops, forgot to mention the shooting ever, you know. And it was just awful. It literally read as if I knew this was going to happen. And so anyway.
Wow.
It was, man. And so, and it was a dual timeline, present day and then going back to 1822. Anyway, long story short, I finally said to Elizabeth, my agent, if I try to rewrite it and include this shooting in the contemporary storyline, will you tell me if it sounds at all like, you know, we're trying to profit off this tragedy? And she said, oh, yeah, I'll tell you, because I do not want my name associated with anything that sounds like, you know. So, I rewrote it, and honestly, it didn't even take much rewriting. It was, again, it was as if it were set up, because it was the history of the city, which, you know, was part of the reason the shooter chose Charleston, because of its long, long history and of both racial violence, but also a lot of racial progress. And so anyway, we included that, and it it was a very interesting process, and it put me in contact with a lot of the real heroes from that city who kept the city from, just being so torn apart. Instead, they showed incredible courage and kindness and unity, and really just set an example for what could happen, and continue to be incredibly brave and forward thinking about how do we do racial justice in ways that are kind and wise and have integrity. So that was just a fascinating, and I don't remember what your question was, but I just rambled.
Well, it was about what was it in your, that you were writing about that sparked that novel. And right. I think you answered it quite well. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Joy Jordan Lake, author of Under a Gilded Moon. Now, was there some specific detail that sparked this book?
Well, there was a moment, really sort of two moments. One, I was in my early 20s, maybe even 20, 21. I was working for, I worked several summers for camps in Western North Carolina during college and graduate school. And that particular summer I was working, this was my favorite job title ever. And if I live to be 140, it will always be my favorite job title. I was the head sailing instructor on Lake Eden at Camp Rockmont for Boys in Black Mountain, North Carolina. And it was just such a fun job, just being out on the lake all day with these sweet boys and very simple sailboats. I'm not a fancy sailor at all. But I had just finished work for the day. I was, just a damp mess of grungy t-shirt and ripped up shorts and, fish fertilizer in my wet hair. And I was coming in from the boats, and some coworkers ran by and said, "Hey, you're invited. A bunch of us who are in charge of the different sports areas are invited to go to Deanie's house for dinner." And I was like, "Who's Deanie?" But yes, I'm in, by the way, if it's, free pizza and I don't have to compete with a bunch of 12-year-old boys, for dinner, eating family style. You don't want to do that with adolescent boys, right? So I just kind of jumped in my 79 Mercury Zephyr and followed. Of course, this is pre-GPS, so I had no idea where I was going. I was just following the guy in front of me. And we stop. We drive about 3 miles up the road. Or no, longer than that, because we were in Black Mountain. But anyway, we drive over to Asheville, and we pull up to the gates of Biltmore Estate. And I'm thinking, well, shoot, I don't even have my billfold on me. I'm just in these grungy shorts, and, we're not going to be able to get in because we can't pay. And the guard just waves us through like we're something special. I thought,
somebody was something special.
Right. I knew it wasn't the person in the, with the first fertilizer hair. And we drive all through kind of these roads of the Biltmore Estate that you don't normally drive on when you come to visit. And I thought, okay, interesting. And all I knew was we were going to the house of the girlfriend of the son of the guy who owned our camp. And this woman named Deanie, and I knew she was my age. So we arrived and we were greeted by Deanie, and she was charming and down to earth and, just as gracious as she could be. And she welcomes us in, and we're sitting there chawing on, pepperoni pizza, and I'm slugging back several Diet Cokes. And I look out, and there's this gorgeous plate glass window that looks out over these beautiful fields. And in the distance, with no obstructions, in the distance is the Biltmore house itself, this 250-room, essentially, castle, this French Renaissance chateau that George Vanderbilt built. And I'm sitting there thinking, what? Okay, this is, my view at that season of life for me was an apartment that was kind of half underground. So my window, literally my view was looking up into the undercarriage of cars in the parking lot, of my, where I lived. And so I was kind of thinking, okay, this Deanie and I are the same age and she seems as down to earth as could be and lovely person. But we seem to be in sort of a different place, in life. And I'm just fascinated looking at this house and thinking, boy, this would be a great place to set a novel someday. And then one of my coworkers clues me in, because apparently I must have looked as clueless as I felt, and said, "Don't you know who Deanie is?" And I said, "No." I said, "No, no, Deanie is Deanie Cecil. She's you know, of the Cecils." Well, I didn't know. And he said, "No, her grandfather, her she's inheriting the Biltmore one day along with her brother. Her great-grandfather was George Vanderbilt." And so I'm sitting there looking out and thinking, but it struck me at the time, not only, you know, one of those funny situations where you're going, wow, okay, this is really interesting. But it just struck me that moment, because I just was so deeply in love with the Western North Carolina mountains and wanted to figure out a way, you know, I could live there the rest of my life. And I was so struck that all I knew about George Vanderbilt at that point was that he was this very, you know, wealthy man from New York who could have lived anywhere he wanted in the world. And he had chosen these mountains that I loved. So that was kind of the moment when I thought, someday this would be fun to write about, you know, to set a mystery there. But then the other quick moment later, years later, I was just a guest at the Biltmore going through it. And our tour guide was one of these just wonderful people who gives you way more information. You know, for every nosy question you ask, he's going to give you an extra bunch of tidbits. And one thing he mentioned was, you know, toward the end of acquiring all this land, George was acquiring it through his agent. But toward the end, so that nobody knew it was Vanderbilt money. But toward the end of this process, they ran up against a couple of families for whom money just had no motivation at all, no motivating power. And the more money they kept offering, these people were like, no, this has been our family farm for this many generations, and no, I'm not moving. And so you had these little islands of just these couple of people who refused to be bought out. And that was another moment where I thought, where it was like the Carrie McGregor character, who's the main character, yeah, it was like she kind of walked in to my head as this woman who's had this chance to become educated and has this chance for this different life in New York City. But she's from these mountains, and she's from one of these farms of a family that refuses to sell. And she's had to come back because of her dying father and make some really hard choices. So that's kind of the moment that came from.
Wow. Well, why don't you read a little bit from the novel for us?
I'd love to. Let me reach for my reading glasses. Isn't that a shame? I need them now. Okay, here we go. Through clouds of steam that swirled around smokestacks and train tracks and billowing skirts, a whistle sounded from Grand Central Depot's farthest platform. Time to face a path she thought she'd outsmarted, outrun, left safely behind. Top hats and bowlers and swooping feathers bobbed as other passengers hurried toward the platform, toward adventures and escapes and secret intrigues. But Carrie McGregor stood still in this moment she dreaded. For her, the whistle was the sound of a summons to a trip she'd give half of Manhattan not to make. Her head, her whole body throbbed with resentment. "There you are," said a voice from behind. The older woman came to stand at Carrie's shoulder. "I hoped I might find you still here." Carrie met Miss Hopkins' gaze, her old teacher's eyes lined at the corners these days, but still full of a steady strength, like an oak you could lean into when you couldn't walk another step. Carrie tried to muster up something to make them both laugh, her old way of handling crises. But her mind, swirling like the smoke, would not focus. Outside, it was still the pitch black of pre-dawn. The gas lanterns lit the depot's platforms in a hazy gold. She looked far down the parallel lines of steel as if she could make out the silhouette of her future, about to be crushed on the tracks. "Thank you for coming." "You know I understand, Carrie, why you feel you've no choice but to go back. And forgive me, but it has to be said, how much it could cost you." They let the words hang between them a moment, along with the steam and the train station scents of hot steel and wet concrete and roasted chestnuts. Carrie's stomach churned. She'd eaten almost nothing since the telegram came 3 days ago. That was part of the churning. But also, chestnuts smelled to her of trouble. She'd gathered them in milk pails back home to help pay the bills. Even after 2 years away, she still felt bile rise in her throat. when she caught the scent of them roasting, taxes unpaid, collectors at the cabin door, her daddy cocking his Remington. Carrie, you'll recall that I know, as few others do, how far the tentacles of poverty reach, how that world can suck you back in. Carrie heard the whish of releasing steam and wondered if she was also hearing her lungs giving up the last of their air. You've worked hard to get to this place. I so hate to see you. Toss my life away? You only have one, you know. Once I've squared things away back home, I could come back. A pause. We haven't much power over Columbia's board, not with so many other worthy young women clamoring for scholarship places at Barnard. But you know we would try, so long, that is, as you manage to keep yourself clear of entanglements. Entanglements. Carrie did not need to ask for specifics. Miss Hobson had been there years ago in the one-room schoolhouse as those attachments had first taken root. The older woman sighed. My dear, I applaud your sense of duty, particularly in the face of, let us say, a less than easy upbringing. Carrie flinched. It was true, and a gross understatement, but painful to hear it spoken out loud. At the far end of the depot came the clanging of a streetcar's bell and the strains of a violinist playing for passers-by change. Closing her eyes, Carrie could hear her little sister on the cowbell, her brother with a banjo made from a gourd and squirrel hide, and their father pulling a slow, mournful ballad from his fiddle. Their father, who could make you weep with the raw beauty, the open wound pain of one of his songs, when he was sober. Their father, who, when he was not, could make you weep for any number of other reasons. Miss Hobson sorted her words with care. I worry for your future, Beck. She paused, as if the North Carolina mountains were too remote from New York to be real. Back there. A conductor on the far platform checked his pocket watch against the depot's clock on its elaborate iron stand near Carrie. She tried not to feel it ticking against the inside of her skull. I understand, Carrie said, and she did, which was why she'd not already clambered onto the train and settled herself by a window so she could watch the land hurtle by in cities and flat, unremarkable farms before at last, beginning to buck and plunge and turn misty blue. She understood this could be a decision that sent her life in a U-turn off the tracks, a complete derailing. Miss Hobson cleared her throat. In the interest of time, allow me to be blunt. How will you handle Dayarg Tate? With any luck, you'll be married by now with triplets, Carrie smiled, which would solve any mishandling I'd be likely to manage. In other words, you're as worried as you ought to be. You know, Carrie, I may look to outsiders like a spinster Barnard professor who knows little of these things. But I can assure you, there are forces beyond the, she rearranged her skirts, beyond the fully rational that can knock a woman completely off course.
Thank you, Joy. That was a great introduction. We didn't really talk about the fact that beyond being a historical novel, this is really a mystery.
It is. I'm just intrigued by, you know, I love puzzles myself and I love mysteries and I just have fun with it myself. So it was kind of partly just to entertain myself, to make it a mystery. And also the setting, the Biltmore House is just, you know, if you can't have a mystery there, you just really, really just can't have a mystery. It's just, you know, these 250 gorgeous rooms and this, you know, these misty mountains and acres of gardens and hundreds of thousands of acres of woods. And so, yeah, it is a mystery. And there's, you know, as you point to, there's also some serious issues behind the murder that are more than just, you know, sort of a cozy parlor room game. You know, there's some real, real evil forces at work here.
I was interested in this Lily, this lady, because she was a friend of his George's niece, right? Is she
right?
She a real
right.
Character?
Exactly.
Was she a real
Lily,
a real person?
The niece is a real character. As I may have mentioned, he was close to a couple of his nieces, and his niece was a real character. The friend is just sort of cobbled together, partly because George was being pursued during this time by lots of young women of means, you know, whose families thought this would be a great idea, right?
Sure.
to have that marriage bond with the Vanderbilts. Of course, the Vanderbilts were new money back in those days, so they had been shunned by some of the old money in New York, but by this point, they had enough money and social clout that they had mostly been accepted in the upper echelon of New York society.
Oh, God.
So Lily's just sort of cobbled together, and as I said, and also sort of in a reverse sort of way, based loosely on Lily Bart. You know, that I love that novel, but I was always heartbroken by the end of House of Mirth, and so I sort of wanted to create a Lily Bart that has her same spunk, but doesn't. Not that we get to see this Lily's end, but I like to think she has a different end.
And the mystery is centered around a murder that happens when they arrive near Biltmore and get off the train, so in the train station. But there's a whole bunch of little mysteries surrounding it. Like, there's so many people that have a connection to it, and it's hard to figure out who you can trust and who... you know, who your main character could trust.
That's right.
Oh, I'm glad you felt that way.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
You always want... It's hard to know, you know, as the writer, when you're being way too obvious and when you're trying so hard to, you know, hide things and drop little red herrings that you've just done nothing but confuse your reader. So, you know, trying to navigate that, you know. Keep the reader just confused enough, but not so much they throw the book across the room, you know.
I think you did a good balance there. So Carrie, you know, she is a very interesting character. And, you know, she's the one who was able to get away to New York, start her education, and then got drawn back. But not, you know, she's in very poor circumstances financially, and yet, as you say, is not drawn towards the money. It would have been very easy for them to just sell out and get the money and not be having to live in a barn because the roof of the house caves in. Why do you think she would be willing to give up so much in order to hold on to the land?
You know, growing up in East Tennessee, I grew up on a place called Signal Mountain, which is right outside Chattanooga, Tennessee. And Signal Mountain on the front side of the mountain is very much sort of just a middle-class, lovely bedroom community of Chattanooga. But on what we call the backside of the mountain, there were both these gorgeous, mostly stone homes of the wealthy families of Chattanooga during the 19th century and early 20th would come up and build these summer houses, but quite large, some of them. So we call that Summertown. But then beyond Summertown were a lot of desperately poor folks, but who came from generations of mountain people who had, you know, who had been farming that land and just been there forever. And some of the conditions were pretty rough. And even during middle school, I look back now and should have been more aware, but I could name you several young women who just sort of disappeared during middle school and high school and from some of these from some of these mountain families. And but there was just a ferocious pride and a lot of dignity. And you could go, I think you still can, on Friday nights to the backside of Signal Mountain, which is called Walden. And you can hear people just show up on Friday nights, or at least they did at the time, once a month, maybe the first Friday of the month. But people would just show up sort of unannounced who might come But sometimes some really well-known, like banjo players, guitarists, like Dolly Parton's lead banjo player would show up, and, you know, just random people. And it was just kind of a jam session. Whoever showed up would play, and people would pass a hat just to kind of pay for the heat in the building. And it was really first-class bluegrass music. But again, you know, you just had this sort of clash of cultures. You had the front side of the mountain. You had your kind of middle class folks who were, you know, planning to go to college and might or might not belong to the country club. And, you know, and then you had your very wealthy Chattanooga families who'd settled in Summertown or at least owned summer homes there. And then you had the mountain folks who, but I was struck not only by the gorgeous, the dulcimer playing and the banjos and the guitars, but also just that fierce independence, and that the land was very important, and legacy and family were all very important. And, you know, you didn't just tell these folks, oh, you know, you could, here's a job with more money. You know, you could, it was all about, you know, it wasn't just about money. And there was a lot of resentment, you know, to just imply that, you know, you could come do this other thing, leave your land and make more money. You know, it was just sort of, you got the feeling sometimes just didn't compute. It was sort of heretical. So anyway, I was just fascinated by that. And one of the many books I read for this was called Spirit of the Mountains, written by a woman named Emma Bell Miles. And she herself was well-educated, but she married a man from Walden, from my mountain, and just she lived a hard life, but she wrote so beautifully about both the beauty of the landscape and the beauty of the people and how much she admired the people, but then also, you know, a lot of hard things about that life. So anyway, she was one of my inspirations as well.
Well, Joy, we're about out of time, but I do want to ask you, in terms of the mystery, did you know from the beginning who done it?
No. In fact, originally someone else did it. And it just didn't sit right, this other person who did it. And one other person, I won't spoil it, but one other person I really wanted to be responsible and really wanted to end a really unfortunate but decisive death. If I really wanted to take out one of my own characters, and I couldn't do it because of what needed to happen, let's just say. But so anyway, it was I really didn't know, and changed it sort of in the final run up, and So there you go. How's that for vague?
pretty darn good. Pretty darn good. Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We've been talking with Joy Jordan Lake, author of Under a Gilded Moon. And Mom, do you have a closing quote for us today?
Well, I do. I got this from the book, actually. To show you how times change, things can change. This was a quote from Lily. We already talked about who she was. Football will not catch on outside a handful of places. Not permanently, anyway. Mark my words.
My son was playing high school football at the time, so I had so much fun researching the beginnings of football and all the predictions that this won't last.
Well, if you're a fan of historical novels and you want something that's maybe set in a little bit of a different place, a little bit of a different story, has a lot of mystery, a little romance, and a lot of sort of reality of the way people live during that time, that's Under a Gilded Moon by Joy Jordan Lake. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you both so much. It's been so much fun talking with both of you. I love the mother-daughter duo. It's awesome.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye, everybody.